This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, June 25th, 2014. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Karnatz. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, summer comes with increased health risks. So we speak with a doctor to learn how to stay safe during the warmer months. Also, we learn about a tick-borne illness called bobcat fever that's affecting local cats.
Plus, Roby Brock from Talk Business and Politics speaks with the CEO of St. Vincent Health System. And in the latest installment of our monthly Three People series, we hear suggestions for how to select a good summer read.
Those stories and more. But first, Governor Mike Beebe is calling for a special session of the legislature to mitigate prison overcrowding and increases in public school employee health insurance premiums. Proposed changes to the health insurance plan include removing part-time workers, reducing eligibility for spouses, and redirecting over $4.5 million in insurance-related tax savings from school districts' discretionary funds. Governor Beebe says what comes out of that special session still won't resolve fundamental problems with increasing premiums.
They're still small in the big scheme of things and incremental. If anybody thinks this is the end-all and the cure-all and the be-all of all this stuff, I suspect they'll be dealing with it for a while. What they did in October last year was the biggest help because it was new real money from the state to teacher insurance.
Similarly, the governor says additional funds to provide 600 new beds for state inmates will help improve the prisoner backlog, but will not solve the underlying issues. Senator Jim Hendren chairs the task force studying public school health insurance and says for most people, a projected premium increase of 35% will be reduced to 10%. Governor Beebe says he's confident the votes are already in place to pass the legislation in 3 days, the minimum allowed under law. The session begins Monday.
A federal report on economic conditions for much of Arkansas highlights optimism in the business community and unemployment levels below the national average, but stagnation wages. UALR economist Michael Paco says the quarterly Burgundy Book, released by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, shows some of the weakest growth is in average personal income. But he says some areas of consumer spending are still growing.
Luxury retailers in Northwest Arkansas reported positive sales growth. That's consistent with some other anecdotal evidence that I've heard around the state that some higher-end household goods seem to be selling pretty well.
The report contains an assessment of the attitudes of business leaders, showing they expect economic conditions to improve throughout the rest of the year. Paco says expectation compares favorably with neighboring zones, encompassing areas around St. Louis and Memphis.
This week, a few hundred volunteers with the World Changers organization are in Fort Smith. Brenda Andrews, a senior planner with the city, says the volunteers will be donating their time and labor to help make repairs to 17 owner-occupied homes in the city.
The World Changers will be doing a week's worth of work for homeowners. They'll be doing exterior repairs as well as interior repairs. That would be including such things as painting, siding, constructing some household ramps. They'll also be doing some interior repairs, repairing some rotten floors, doing just some general interior repairs. So a lot of good things will be happening this week.
Andrew says the donated labor brings benefit to what otherwise would be costly repairs to homes in the city.
In this list, there are 15 families that might not have otherwise been able to get on the list for any kind of repairs through CDBG, because obviously the repairs would have been much more. Just simply painting a house could be several thousand dollars. Compare that with just now all that's required is the paint and the paint brushes and the labor's free. So it's just been wonderful how the cost savings that we have realized in the 5 years since we've been working with World Changers. They have made repairs to over 80 houses, and that's not including the ones that they're working on this year.
The material for 15 of the repair jobs that World Changers will be working on was paid for through the City of Fort Smith's Community Development Block Grant Housing Assistance Program. And material for the other two repair jobs is being paid for with private funds. World Changers was established in 1990 and is operated through a network of Southern Baptist and other evangelical churches.
The city of Fayetteville recently unveiled a new web application to make finding city services simpler for city residents. Greg Mitchell, the city's director of Geographic Information Systems, or GIS for short, says the city's GIS service provider developed My Fayetteville Services.
So they develop a number of apps to help their clients, which include cities all over the world, to make their data available to their citizens. So they have this, it's a template, really, that we could download, and then we use our own data that we maintain locally to, we plug it in, basically. And this application, it was just a good fit for what we wanted. It was exactly what we wanted to show, you know, trash day and zoning and floodplain and how to get to various city buildings.
But Mitchell says while the web application provides a handy resource for residents wanting to find city buildings, there are a few services that couldn't be added to the app, like a point-and-click resource for school zones.
We couldn't do all that. Same with elected representatives. We wanted to show not just your city elected alderman, but also your JP, your state representatives, national representatives, etc. So that was probably a primary limitation. There were some other things that are data that we don't maintain. For example, the polling place. That's not a city function, you know. That's controlled, that's organized at the county level. So while we wanted to be able to list a polling place, but that changes with every election, and we don't have the information to keep up with that. So in that case, we provided a link to the county website.
Mitchell says the city's GIS staff is still working on ways to include data for school boundaries and elected representatives to the app, but there is no time frame for when those additions could appear in the app. He says the easiest way to access the new app is to visit the city's homepage, fayetteville-ar.gov, and to click the icon for My Fayetteville Services.
Sales tax will be a little higher in Elkins after yesterday's special election. 174 people, or 79% of the vote, cast their ballots in favor of the 3/4% sales tax increase, which will go toward debt service on $2.35 million in bonds to be used for public recreational facilities in the city.
8 new scholarships for teacher education students have been created at the University of Arkansas. The James Patterson Teacher Education Scholarship was created last academic year for 8 incoming freshmen planning to major in elementary education, and the internationally acclaimed author has again funded the scholarships to the tune of $96,000.
About a year ago, the Eureka Springs Downtown Network was designated an accredited Main Street Arkansas program. But yesterday, it announced that it has now received national accreditation. Eureka Springs Main Street program was designated as such for meeting commercial district revitalization performance standards set by the National Main Street Center, which is a subsidiary of the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Officials with the Eureka Springs Downtown Network say they are currently working on a long-term development plan for the town's actual Main Street and the staircases that lead to it from Spring Street.
Lloyd Warren of Fayetteville, a professor emeritus of entomology at the University of Arkansas, died Sunday. He was a Navy veteran of World War II and served on the faculty of the University of Arkansas for more than 20 years. He was the director of the Arkansas Agricultural Experiment Station for a decade. He is also one of the namesakes of the Crawley Warren Laboratory on the UA Fayetteville campus. He was 98 years old. Tonight's weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy skies with a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms in northwest Arkansas, a 30% chance of showers in the Arkansas River Valley, and lows in the upper 60s. Partly sunny tomorrow with a 30% chance of showers and highs from 83 to 87 degrees. Tomorrow night, expect mostly cloudy conditions with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms and lows around 70. Dr. Angela Rose started the Cat Clinic of Northwest Arkansas nearly 25 years ago. Every day, the veterinarian sees several feline patients with varying ailments, including one called cytozoonosis, which is more commonly known as bobcat fever. caused by the protozoan parasite Cytozoan felis. It's a tick-borne disease that affects domestic cats. The name bobcat fever comes from the fact that bobcats are carriers of the disease, which typically does not affect the wild animals. Sources vary on the exact time and place of the first reported incidents of bobcat fever, but according to a 2009 article from members of the Department of Pathology in the College of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Georgia, the parasite was first identified and described in North America in 1979. The parasite is transmitted through the saliva of ticks, and Dr. Rose says the disease used to be considered 100% lethal. However, that statistic has improved, and the veterinarian estimates her clinic saves 70 to 80% of the cats they see with bobcat fever. The disease is still being studied, and Dr. Rose believes over the years, the illness has changed.
Well, it's controversial. Some parasitologists say there's one strain, but at Cornell, they're actually working on typing the strains now. They feel like there's multiple strains. I feel like there's multiple strains. Because I have some cats that just don't appear that sick with it, and then I have some cats that come in and it's lethal within 24 hours. So that's why it is urgent to get them in, because there is no way that we can determine if it's the cat that is responding to the organism differently, or are there going to be multiple strains of it now? So there's a lot of research being done.
Since seeing the first two suspected cases of bobcat fever in January, more and more infected cats have been admitted to the Rogers Clinic. Suspected cases of bobcat fever rose to 4 in February, 5 in March, 10 in April, 11 in May, and 14 in June, as of June 24th. Dr. Rose says infected domestic cats typically become very lethargic and hot. If the cats get really sick quickly, the disease will affect the animals neurologically. The disease affects the heart and lungs, so the animals have difficulty breathing. Dr. Rose says the cats often vocalize a strange sound and will become jaundiced. The organism causing bobcat fever is initially in the bloodstream, so a blood test can confirm the existence of the disease. Because the blood sample must be sent to Memphis to be analyzed, it can take 1 to 3 business days to receive results. Some cats cannot afford to wait that long, so Dr. Rose will often begin treatment immediately on an animal she suspects has bobcat fever.
Well, there was a study done in Missouri where they felt like their success rate was higher than the drug that had been commonly used, which was imidacarb. I did not participate in that study because it was not a broad enough spectrum drug to get some of our other tick-transmitted diseases. In that study, they did save 66% of the cats, I believe, but it was only done on 22 cats. I'll see 22 cats in a month, and so I feel like that I still use the imidacarb. And the Missouri protocol, and I'm asked that frequently because people Google all the time, and they ask me why I'm not using the Missouri protocol. I feel like the imidacarb does work better. I do keep the Missouri protocol here, which is Azithromax and Mepron. It is a very expensive drug, the Mepron. So if I have an owner that is willing to do both, I'll do both. And if I have an owner that can't afford the Mepron, then I definitely use the imidacarb. I feel like that I've had a very good success rate using imidacarb.
Dr. Angela Rose says one complication of the Missouri protocol is it requires the medication to be taken orally, and sometimes cats are so sick they have difficulty swallowing the liquid. Because cats seem to react differently to the disease, the dosage of medicine the veterinarian administers varies from case to case. One of the best ways to combat the disease is to keep cats from being bitten by ticks. Dr. Rose says sometimes symptoms don't appear until 7 to 14 days after a tick has attached and fed on the animal. To aid in prevention, she recommends the use of a new collar called Seresto, which was created by Bayer Healthcare. According to a press release from the company, the Seresto collar provides, for the first time, a cat product to repel ticks. One tick known to be a disease vector for bobcat fever is the Lone Star tick. Dr. Kelly Lofton, an associate professor in the University of Arkansas's entomology department, says the Lone Star tick is probably the most abundant tick in Arkansas.
A lot of people are calling me this year because they think ticks are more abundant. and they may be locally more abundant. But another thing that probably came into play with seeing a lot of ticks in May and June was the fact that we had a cool spring. Some of these ticks, Lone Star ticks, didn't become active till a little bit later, so there was a larger number active at once.
Lofton says Lone Star ticks in many ways are opportunistic in that they'll feed on a variety of hosts. When he was in grad school, Lofton says the Lone Star tick was not considered to be very important in terms of disease transmission.
The American dog tick was more important because of Rocky Mountain spotted fever, things like that. If you look at now, I mean, we're finding that Lone Star tick is important with ehrlichiosis, southern tick-associated rash illness, this heartland virus, and bobcat fever in cats. You know, it's only been within the last 4 or 5 years that they've determined that the Lone Star tick is really important in terms of transmitting bobcat fever. Before that, they thought it was the American dog tick primarily.
Lofton says people have said it seems like ticks have been worse in recent years, and he notes that there's a lot of evidence that suggests that an increase in the Lone Star tick population coincides with an increase in deer herd. However, Lofton says this is not the worst year he has seen. He says in general, the tick population is fairly consistent. The exception would be in extremely dry years because some ticks, like the Lone Star tick, prefer a humid environment. To prevent cats from being bitten by ticks, Lofton suggests pet owners keep their grass cut. A small yard could also be treated with insecticide. It's important for pet owners to protect themselves from ticks as well, because humans could easily bring ticks inside their home that could attach to their indoor pets. If a cat does become sick from a tick-borne illness like bobcat fever, Dr. Angela Rose stresses the importance of seeking immediate medical attention.
Tick prevention is very important, and if this time of year, or any time of the year, if they're really having a bad day, you know, don't hesitate. You know, try to get them right in to see their veterinarian and make sure, because the sooner that we can treat them, the more likely we are to be able to save them.
More information is available at thecatclinicofnwarkansas.com.
The lead discoverer of Earth 2.0, this week on Planetary Radio. Elisa Quintana is the young researcher whose name was at the top of the paper announcing discovery of Kepler-186f, the first Earth-sized exoplanet found in its star's habitable zone.
Planetary Radio begins Thursday evening at 6 on KUAF3.
Summer is typically when most people have time for vacations, relaxing, or catching up on things that need to be done. Sometimes one of the things you need to catch up on is your reading list. But how do you decide what book is worth your time?
It used to be, you know, whatever people are talking about, whatever, you know, caught my fancy. And now I try to read books that are coming out shortly so that I can, you know, recommend them or decide if I want to stock them. Publishers, it's lovely when the UPS man comes because I almost always have at least a dozen advanced copies of books. And out of that, maybe two or three are things that I might want to keep in the store. And so that's what I read. Two or three times a year, I reward myself with a book that I just want.
How to pick your next summer read coming up in the second half hour of Ozarks at Large.
Summer, warmer, longer days, floating on Arkansas's lakes and rivers, lounging by the pool, biking and hiking our area's trails, and hopefully no visits to the emergency room. Summer does come with some increased risks. Swimming accidents, boating accidents, and sunburn are a few of the more obvious hazards. Ozarks at Large's Sara Burningham paid a visit to Bella Vista's Mercy Clinic and asked Dr. Scott Estes about how to keep you and your family members out of the ER this summer. Dr. Estes says the number one danger is something we get plenty of in summer here in Northwest Arkansas, heat.
Prepare, hydrate, don't get yourself out in a situation where you can't get out of the heat. Be respectful of the heat.
According to the Arkansas Department of Health, between January 1, 2008 and December 31, 2013, more than 300 people were taken to a hospital because of heat-related illness in our state. Dr. Scott Estes at Mercy Clinic in Bella Vista says high temperatures are made more dangerous by high humidity, preventing sweat from evaporating fast enough to allow your body to cool naturally.
People just don't hydrate enough. They probably don't prepare ahead of time when they're going to be out in the really hot and humid weather, because you really have to anticipate that and start hydrating really well before you go out. And so if someone goes out, say, just to do what they think is going to be light yard work, and it's one of our really, really hot summer days, and it's very humid, and they get busy, it can really get away from them before they realize it. And they may start trying to catch up by getting some fluids, but sometimes, especially in the elderly or people who have other chronic medical conditions, they never will catch up. So they will find themselves, you know, maybe feeling lightheaded, may have a little bit of shortness of breath. If they stop sweating, that's really a bad sign. That's a sign that you're really significantly dehydrated. And mental status changes is the big thing. A person can actually suffer pretty significant brain damage as a result of heat-related illness.
So you've hydrated. You've prepared for the heat. You're headed out and about in this beautiful corner of the natural state. But there's danger in the bushes. We're talking ticks.
The big things to be concerned about with tick bites, really three illnesses for the most part, and that would be Rocky Mountain spotted fever, Lyme disease, and another condition called borreliosis. There is a good rule of thumb about a tick bite, and that is that it really takes about 24 hours from the time that a tick attaches before it can actually burrow into the skin deep enough to actually transmit any disease. So if you find a tick and you know that it's been there less than 24 hours, then you probably don't have anything to worry about. If you can't tell how long it's been on, or if you know it's been attached for more than 24 hours, then you do have to be concerned about the possibility of transmission of disease. And usually I just recommend people call their doctor about that. Most of the times, just to be safe, the doctor will prescribe the antibiotic that would treat those things. If you haven't had medical attention and you remember that you had a tick bite and then you start having some symptoms suggestive of disease, then that's where it gets a little bit more tricky. But the main things there are fever, joint pain, and then there are certain rashes that are associated with these different vectors that, a physician would need to look at.
And as for getting rid of ticks, here's Dr. Estes' rundown on removing your unwelcome guest.
Take a fine point tweezer, get down very close to the skin where you can get the head of the tick, and just extract it. Really shouldn't try to jerk it out quickly, just slowly extract it. And then you look at the area with a magnifying glass, see if you see any signs of debris still in the bite site. And if there is, it'll usually actually come out on its own, or you can just take the end of a sterilized needle and just lightly scrape it out. The main key is don't just grab it by the body and pull it out. You need to get a pair of tweezers and get down at the head of the tick and extract it that way.
And here's another summer safety concern, snake bites.
The main concerns in this part of the country are probably copperheads. I think we see more bites of that from that snake than anything else that are serious. You know, rattlers and water moccasins or cottonmouths are present too. Contrary to what you see in the movies like in True Grit, where you have to get somebody to the hospital at a certain time before they die, people typically don't develop systemic reactions and have the threat of death associated with a snake bite. It can occur. What it actually causes is some problems with the blood's clotting mechanism, and it can produce some serious systemic effects rarely. But usually what you get is just a very localized severe inflammation that causes a lot of painful swelling where the bite occurred. We've all seen cutting the wound open and sucking the venom out, or using suction cups and doing things like that. And I remember when I was a Boy Scout, they used to have the kits for us to do that. But the best bet really is just get to medical care as quick as you can.
Summer also comes with a whole lot of self-inflicted injuries. Dr. Estes has some pretty basic advice to avoid the ER with those.
There's a saying that says, you can't beat stupid. So people who do foolish things are going to have foolish outcomes. You don't need to be jumping off of cliffs on the Buffalo River headfirst into the river. That's a good way to have a very, very bad outcome. You shouldn't be climbing in areas where you can fall off and seriously injure yourself. You shouldn't be running the lawnmower by the window where you can put a rock through the window. There's not anything magical about that. I think it's just people need to be ever vigilant and use common sense. But we certainly do see all manner of accidents that will occur just from people being out and being more active.
Another medical complaint that rises with the temperatures is food poisoning.
People are eating outside more. They're relying on other types of refrigeration other than their nice in-home refrigerator. Maybe they're carrying things to the lake or they're carrying things out somewhere and just have it on ice. And there are certain foods that are just not going to stay very fresh that way very well. And you do certainly have the possibility of getting a foodborne infection. So you just need to be very, very cautious about making sure that those foods stay cold. It would be things like anything that is milk-based or potato salad and things of that sort need to make sure that they stay very, very cold and don't let them ever reach room temperature or certainly not outside temperature.
Remember to keep that instant read meat thermometer handy if you're grilling, just to make sure your choice cuts have reached the FDA recommended minimum internal temperatures. Finally, Dr. Estes says that you want to avoid the emergency room even if you do get bit, hit, hot, or sick this summertime.
Our emergency rooms are pretty well flooded. And so if you're relying on the emergency room to provide, the bulk of your medical care, you're going to be frustrated. You're going to be aggravated at the time it takes. Plus, it's just not the best utilization of resources. So I would certainly encourage everyone to have a primary care physician that can take care of the bulk of their medical needs. And all of the things that we've mentioned here, other than, serious life-threatening injuries, can generally be evaluated by a primary care physician in a clinic setting. And there are many clinics that have extended hours where they're available, in the nighttime and on the weekend as well. So I just really encourage people, if they can, get established with a primary care physician or with a system which has those capabilities to meet their medical care without them having to go to an emergency room.
Sarah Birmingham for Ozarks at Large.
It is Wednesday, June 25th, 2014, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Really fascinating visual arts.
Okay.
It's time for the River Valley Invitational at the Fort Smith Regional Art Museum, and the winner is from Clarksville. Her name's Dawn Holder, and she did this amazing installation.
Mm-hmm.
It's grass, but it's not grass because it's made out of porcelain.
Huh.
About 75,000 little individually crafted and then glazed pieces of porcelain.
That sounds like way more patience than I have.
It is a fascinating piece of art. And they have 51 other works by 42 other artists from all over the region, including some entrants from Florida, Mexico, and Texas. And the show will be open through September 14th, so you have plenty of time to go and see if the grass really is greener in Fort Smith. Admission is, I believe, free to this particular exhibit, but you can check at fsram.org.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Hi, everyone. This is Pat Mitchell-Worley. Coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan, we'll have the one and only Eden Brent on the show. And Poppy Tooker will continue her look at food and the blues. That's coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Listen to Beale Street Friday nights at 8 on 91.3 FM.
The 64th Annual Opera in the Ozarks runs through July 18th at Inspiration Point near Eureka Springs, with performances held at the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville on June 29th, July 6th, and July 11th. This season includes Cozy Fantute, Into the Woods, Gianni Schicke, and Suar Angelica. Tickets and more information available at opera.org. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Karnatz.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. St. Vincent's Health System has been a part of the Arkansas healthcare scene for more than 125 years. Its parent company, Catholic Health Initiatives, has been making major moves in the last 2 months to reshape that landscape. An acquisition of QualChoice Health Insurance and a merger with Hot Springs-based Mercy Hot Springs Hospital and a partnership discussion with Conway Regional Hospital. Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics recently sat down with Peter Banco, CEO of St. Vincent Health, to get his take on the health beat.
Well, let's start first with the Hot Springs Hospital. Yes. And what's going on there with Mercy Hot Springs. 282 beds, I think, down there to go with your more than 650 at St. Vincent's. Tell me, what's the economics of that deal?
You know, they had a failed merger with National Park due to FTC and Vatican concerns, so we came in on the back end of that. We think we need to have more scale to be relevant, so getting some economies of scale, getting larger is a good thing, having a larger footprint than just maybe Little Rock, North Little Rock, Morrilton was in our future. And so the mission and values were very closely aligned, so that's why we went after that opportunity to acquire that facility there. So yes, a large hospital, really a hub for Southwest Arkansas, cardiology, orthopedics, neurosurgery, oncology, and then about 120 employed physicians. So really a robust, vibrant healthcare scene in Hot Springs.
So now if I'm looking at the map, you go Morrilton, Hot Springs, obviously Central Arkansas, you're missing a little butterfly wing on the eastern flank there. So maybe something could be, maybe something in the works there.
Well, you know, the growth corridors in this area are down I-30, Benton Bryant, and then Conway to Russellville, so and a little, probably up to Searcy. So you'll probably see more activity down to Pine Bluff in those areas, maybe not going as far east.
Yeah. Let's talk about the Conway affiliation. Conway Regional Hospital, you guys are just in discussions right now. Nothing's been tremendously formalized, but kind of bring me up to speed with where that discussion is at this point in time.
Yes, we're in confidential discussions. We've developed a framework to work with one another that I can't talk about.
Sure.
And we're working through the letter of intent process, and hopefully that'll start speeding things up where we can start working more closely together.
But tell me why an affiliation versus a full-blown buyout might make more sense. Kind of what's the difference between what you did in Hot Springs and what you're doing in Conway?
I get to know each other. So it's like living together, which you're not supposed to do as a Catholic, but it's like living together before you get married. So getting to know each other, starting to work together so that you feel, rather than going all in and then figuring things didn't work, getting to know each other, work on some things, and as that gains momentum, maybe then if it makes sense to integrate more deeply. Now, for not every organization, ownership, sale, giving up things makes sense. So preserving the autonomy of the Conway Regional Board, preserving that leadership team, they've been around for decades too. So keeping what they're doing best and bringing the advantages of a large regional and national health system to bear.
Well, maybe not living with each other. How about just a long-term dating relationship?
Yes.
There?
Yeah. Yes.
Is that a little bit better?
Yeah.
Let's talk too about the Catholic Health Initiative's acquisition of QualChoice. I know you weren't necessarily involved in that, and you're not in that leadership organization other than just the parent company tie there, but it speaks to a little bit larger picture of healthcare reform and what we are seeing happen, not just in the Arkansas market, but nationally. Tell me how that that transaction, how does that play into what's been going on in terms of federal healthcare reform for the last few years?
So you're gonna see the blurring of lines between hospitals, physicians, outpatient, and payers. So that's the CHI's acquisition of QualChoice down that end. So we have stated that we're gonna start to blend those lines. We acquired a Medicare Advantage plan in the Pacific Northwest outside of Seattle as our first QualChoice after the departure of the U of A employees. Needed a partner, and we were the logical choice to do that. So it was really allowing us nationally to get into the health plan business less expensively, build a platform for national health plans, and also provide some more competition in Arkansas.
Well, and now, and part of the information that was released as part of that deal described this as making healthcare more affordable, more accessible. That was supposed to be, is supposed to be the goal of the federal healthcare overhaul.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the federal healthcare overhaul has spent more time on contracting costs. So, you know, Medicare cuts, Medicaid cuts, disproportionate share cuts to providers. So it's focused more on the cost side. I don't think we've seen the transformation enough to start to impact quality, but you will over time. There's going to be a shift from fee-for-service to fee-for-value. Mm-hmm. I think that'll take time, and different markets are working at different speeds.
What are you seeing in terms of accessibility, though? It seems like from a lot of the data we're getting, at least in terms of the private option, and I use that as just kind of a slice of what's happening in the overall healthcare market, we do seem to be seeing more people accessing the system because they've got health insurance now.
We're definitely seeing more people access our primary care physicians and our employed network. We're seeing rapid growth in our emergency department visits as well. We're seeing individuals.
So you're seeing an increase in emergency room visits.
Yeah, rather almost hockey stick exponential growth, where we had been flat at St. Vincent for a while. We're seeing month to month huge increases.
That is a little bit of a contradiction to what some other hospital executives have said they have seen in terms of emergency room visits. They've seen a decline in that from some legislative testimony. Do you know why you're seeing the increase?
We're just doing a better job in our emergency room, and people
they're all
are coming
there.
To us. Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, we have spent a lot of time on efficiency and process in our ERs, and we were stagnant, but we are seeing an uptick in ER visits.
Is that
visits.
A good thing for you? Do you want to see more emergency room visits?
It's not the best place for folks to get care. You should be going to a primary care physician, your pediatrician, your family practitioner, your internist, your OBGYN. So certain things belong in the ER, other things belong elsewhere. I mean, we've been seeing a proliferation of urgent care centers, at least in the Little Rock mm-hmm. market, too, and they all seem to be doing pretty well. And our West Little Rock urgent care center is doing well, too. So I don't know what others are seeing. We're seeing an uptick in those urgent emergency visits.
Lots of data to kind of analyze and look at. I know you're a data freak, which I like about you so much. So what are you seeing in terms of some of the reforms going on at the state level to try to bend healthcare costs? Obviously, the private option, another big kind of component of state healthcare reform. You mentioned the payment initiative that has been underway for some time. Is it working?
I think Governor Beebe's trials in bundled payment and the medical home are definitely working. We're seeing right now, we're also in a Medicare pilot for bundled payment, and we're seeing for hips and knee replacement, we're seeing large reductions in costs. We're able to, our physicians along with the hospital and hip and knee replacement have really gotten together, looked at better quality, better reducing infection rates, how to provide lower costs, not withholding care, but we know when someone goes to rehab or a skilled nursing facility, the infection rate gets higher. So our physicians try to discharge people home with home care. So it's really, I think, better coordinated care and improved care. And we're seeing reduced costs at St. Vincent because of it.
That was Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business and Politics, speaking with Peter Banco, CEO of St. Vincent Health System. Support for Talk Business and Politics on Ozarks at Large is provided by AT&T, challenging drivers to take the pledge to never text and drive. No text is worth the risk. More information at itcanwait.com. And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com.
And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas. Diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity, backed up with fuel diversity. Coal, oil, natural gas, hydropower, and renewables. More at AECC.com. And the Arkansas State Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Arkansas. More at ArkansasStateChamber.com. This is Ozarks at Large. Packing for the summer vacation might require sunscreen, a map or GPS device, and, for many of us, a book or two thrown into the suitcase. But if you've exhausted the collected works of your favorite authors or just want something different, how do you find something worth your time? Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellum sought out three opinions on how to find a good book.
It is a common observation, the desire to have more time to read all the books worth reading. Not many of us feel we have that time, but surely, if you're a librarian or you own a bookstore, you do, right?
Wouldn't it be nice?
Heather Robidoux is Assistant Manager of Adult Services at the Fayetteville Public Library. We also heard the commiserating laughter from Lisa Sharp, owner of Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in downtown Fayetteville. I asked the two of them about the process of finding books to read. Lisa, the bookstore owner, says her way of picking a book to read has changed over time.
It used to be, you know, whatever people are talking about, whatever, you know, caught my fancy. And now I try to read books that are coming out shortly so that I can, you know, recommend them or decide if I want to stock them. Publishers, it's lovely when the UPS man comes because I almost always have at least a dozen advanced copies of books. And out of that, maybe two or three are things that I might want to keep in the store. And so that's what I read. Two or three times a year, I reward myself with a book that I just want.
Yeah, how often do you get to read something that is purely for pleasure?
Most of what I stock in the store is stuff I would want to read at some point. So a lot of the advanced readers that I read are books that, you know, I'm enjoying. They just might not be my first choice.
Heather?
Probably once every month or two. I mean, I'll have time to just pick up something purely for pleasure. But so much of what I read that is tied in with something else is still pleasurable. It just may not have been my very first choice on the top of my reading list.
So let's start with the professional world, because people like me will come in, Lisa, and say, what should I get? What's good? You have book clubs, so you have this sort of sense of responsibility a little bit.
It's
so true. How do you determine out of those, that UPS delivery that brings a dozen, how do you determine which two or three or five or six you might read?
Well, my husband made a joke once that I read the bad books so you don't have to, which is sometimes true. I might go through, you know, the first half of a book and say, you know, this is just absolutely not for us and won't read it. I do look for authors that I know people are aware of. I get book recommendations from other booksellers. Even when we get those advanced copies, there's other booksellers who have said, this was great, you should try it. So we all depend on each other for recommendations. There's no way that anybody can know of every book out there.
Yeah. How do you have it for the book clubs?
Well, you know, for the book clubs, we've got different types, but we try to have kind of a balance of all sorts of different things. So a lot of our first call through things are through book reviews, and we'll make a list and we kind of divide them up as a committee and read different things and say what this has a lot of things to talk about, you know, current issues, things we know Fayetteville or the area would like. We have a pretty good sense of the folks that come to those. But yeah, we'll make all year long we have a running list of things, of prospects that we run into. So and then we make the hard decisions when it comes time to select for the next year.
I walk in and say, you know what? I don't want to read what I've been reading. I want something completely different. Do you ever get that? It's like, So what do you do for someone who
First
makes
you
that impossible
find out,
request?
You've got to find out what they've been reading so you're not in the same pool. That's one of the areas where, you know, the fiction versus nonfiction, even maybe some poetry, go something really, really out there. If they want to experiment, it's pretty easy. Short stories, if they only read novels or only read mysteries and want something different, you can jump to a different style of writing and often satisfy kind of that new experimentation that they want. And there's a lot of great authors out there, so it's usually not too hard.
To me, it's thrilling when somebody comes in and says, recommend a book to me, because that's what I'm trying to do, is put books in people's hands. And I read pretty widely, so I can usually find something in a section that they haven't read from, or I've got booksellers who have, because we talk to each other about what we've read, so it's not just me. It's like the library staff. I'm sure y'all share book reviews with each other. So I just kind of pull on what I've liked and try some things.
If someone says, okay, I know that I want to read more and I want to expand, what's the best way to do that? I like to look at the New York Times book review, but what happens there is I get overwhelmed because I'll circle nine books.
I do that too.
And it's like, well, I don't have $2,000 to spend this week. So, and then they kind of go away. So what would you recommend for people who are searching?
Well, the American Booksellers Association puts out a monthly promotional material with books that were recommended by booksellers across the country. And that is, I think, about 25 books. A lot of times it's authors you don't know. So it's always a good starting place if you've read everything by your favorite author and you don't know where to go. I pick up a lot of books from that. And then, you know, just talk to people. People that you trust. You've got a certain list of people that you'll trust.
you develop it over time.
Uh-huh.
That brings brings up an interesting point, and I may be romanticizing here, but I think there was a time before I was an adult where people would meet at parties and they would actually, many of them, have read the same book. Mm-hmm. That phenomenon doesn't seem to exist, partly because there's so many things you can read. But, you know, Ernest Hemingway used to be on the cover of Life. William Faulkner was a household name. I don't know of many living authors that you would call household names that are considered really good authors consistently.
I don't remember the number, but it's a very low percentage of people who read more than one book a year, which surprises me because those are not the people that I surround myself with. But and I think people just don't read as much, so they don't have it to talk about. They may talk about playing Candy Crush or Angry mm-hmm. Birds or something. But.
Well, and I think the reading has changed. A lot of people are reading online. They're getting their news online. They're reading articles and things through mobile devices. Well, some of it is download. We're really encouraging the downloadable books. But I think it's just the whole picture of what reading is has changed with technology.
Heather Robidoux is Assistant Manager of Adult Services at the Fayetteville Public Library. We also heard from Lisa Sharp, owner of Nightbird Books on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. Originally, the plan was to have three people together in the same room to talk about their methods of discovering a good book or a new author. But if scheduling enough time for reading is difficult, imagine getting people together to talk about reading. It's even harder. So the third opinion I sought out had to come to our studio later. Nicholas Claro is a writer and also an avid reader. Do you read a lot?
I do.
Nicholas doesn't work at a library. He doesn't own a bookstore. He says most of the reading he does is purely for the pleasure of reading.
You know, I started out reading, you know, the old classics, the Hemingway and a lot of old Russian folks and stuff like that. And then when I was at school, you know, when I started writing my own fiction, you know, you're in class with a lot of other people who are doing the same. And, you know, it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, who do you read? Like, who's your influence? And then we kind of swapped.
So let's say you wake up on a Tuesday morning or a Tuesday, you get off work on a Tuesday afternoon and you want to pick up a new book. Do you always know what it's going to be?
No, not always. I mean, you know, there's still a lot of books on my shelf that I've yet to read, but they've been recommended. And so just, you know, I'll either peruse that shelf or, you know, there's Nightbird or the Dixon Bookstore, which are great, and, you know, kind of go along there and talk to Matt or Chris down there and ask them what, you know, they're reading or have read. So never a clear idea, but usually I find something that I enjoy.
Do you ever seek out book reviews like literary journals or the New York Times book review section or anything like that?
I don't. I would rather get an opinion from somebody who, you know, I've, you know, had things passed off that have been good. And, you know, general reviews I typically don't pay too much attention to.
Do people ask you for recommendations?
Yeah, you know, my circle of friends who, you know, we all write, we'll come across, you know, sitting down, end up inevitably talking about writing our books and be like, hey, you know, I read this. A good friend of mine in town, Tom Cochran, every time we get together for a beer, you know, he's bringing me, you know, a short story from The New Yorker that he's photocopied or a book. And so he and I swap.
Well, you know, and you bring up an interesting point because I've been concentrating on books, on novels or collections. That's not the only place to find fiction or nonfiction that you want to read, is it?
No, I mean, now, you know, with Facebook and Twitter and all these, you know, social media apps and all that stuff, I mean, you know, scrolling through and, you know, it'll have a blurb of a writer and, you know, that's how, you know, you can find a ton of stuff is online. There's, you know, the New Yorker, Harper's, there's Best American Short Stories, which, you know, all these little collections and anthologies they put out. And so,
let's say I release you into a bookstore. Let's say I release you into Dixon Street Bookstore. I tell you, you're going to be in there for 3 hours. You're going to come away with 4 books, but I don't want it to be by any book to be by someone you've read before.
Oh, wow.
But you can explore. How would you go about that? Or have you even, or is it even possible to think about how you go about that?
I mean, yeah, I mean, those shelves are packed, but I mean, I would say, you know, just pick something off. I mean, a lot of the times, you know, there'll be an author blurb on the back, and let's say, you know, Robert Boswell says something good about this book, chances are I'll pick it up and at least give that a try. So I guess going back to reviews and all that stuff, it's kind of the same deal. The general reviews I won't pay attention to, but, you know, if an author blurbs a book that I've not heard of, chances are I'll pick it up.
So it can be overwhelming because there are more books and there's more access to books than ever before. What if someone says, hey, I just want to, I've read everything by my, you know, I've gone through Hemingway, I've gone through Faulkner, I've gone through whomever, I've gone through Joyce Carol's, I want to find something new, maybe even something different than I've read. What's the best way for someone to find out something else to read?
You know, apart from just, you know, asking circles of friends, I would say, you know, especially if they're trying to find a new author, pick up these, you know, these little anthologies. You know, I found so many short fiction writers that I absolutely revere over the last few years just by, you know, reading one story and then looking at, you know, I still remember it's stories, New Stories from the South, I believe, and it was edited by Amy Hempel, and there's a story in there called Retreat by Wells Tower that was amazing. And then, you know, Googled his name and then realized that the year prior he had come out with a collection called Everything Ravaged, Everything Burned, and, you know, picked that up, devoured it, and, you know, little outlets like that seem to help out.
Nicholas Claro is a writer and avid reader, and one of three people whose opinion I sought out to figure out how to find good, unfamiliar books to spend time with this summer. It wasn't that long ago, at the dawn of the digital age, predictions were made about the demise of the library and the locally owned independent bookstore. But the obituary was written too early, and that's partly because, as Heather Robidoux from the Fayetteville Public Library and Lisa Sharp from Nightbird Books point out, those places are more than just books. You go over to the library any day of the week, and there's all sorts of things happening.
Yes, it's certainly it's entertainment, it's learning of in all capacities, from programming, like I say, different technologies, just to experience it, even if you're not there to use it. Just sometimes people will come in just to kind of see what something is, to experience it, and you just never know what you're going to run into. The library, we're always doing new things.
Yeah, so it's lots of fun.
It is. It's lots of fun, and it's constantly evolving. And while it's challenging to keep up with, it's challenging for everyone to keep up with. So we're there, a place for the community to come in and just kind of experiment.
And Lisa, at Nightbird, you're about to have your
eighth.
Really, eighth anniversary.
Yes.
Your space there on Dixon, you might walk in. There's music. There might be a club, a book club. There might be a reader, an author. So you're going to celebrate, right?
Yes, we are. July 7th through 12th, every day of the week, we're going to do something that we do all year long. But for this one week, we're asking you to pay for what you come to do at the bookstore, because we really do want to be a community place, just like the library, a place where readers and writers can come together. But, you know, we're a bookstore, and it takes a little help from the community to stay in business.
Finally, one last question for all three of the readers I talked to. Is there a book so good that you read it over and perhaps over again?
Tinkers by Paul Harding. It's a gem of a book, a little tiny, thin book that looks like a fast read, but it is just a slow wash right over you. It's just a brilliant book. I highly recommend it. So every so often I have to pick that one up and reread it.
Possession by A.S. Bio is the one I read every year.
Yeah, there's a few short story collections by Tobias Wolfe, like Our Story Begins. I try to read Anna Karenina once a year during the holidays. And then, you know, I read a lot of short fiction, so the stuff that I revisit are typically collections.
Thanks to Nicholas Claro, Lisa Sharp, and Heather Robidoux for their time and their recommendations. And if there is an undiscovered gem you think we should know about, perhaps even read more than once, send us your book suggestions, and we'll pass them along as the summer continues. You can email your recommendations to ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Crosses.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Karnatz.
Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back along with Kyle Kellums. We'll end today's show with some music by Matt Stell. The song is called Grass Looks Greener, and he will have a free concert tomorrow night at George's. More information at mattstell.com. Thanks again for listening, and have a great day.
There's more stars out here than most folks see, hanging just beyond your reach. Miles of cotton on this old